You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. Yet you still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is, managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all of your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money you wasted. Plus, you can use the smart savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved them more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play stores.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly!
Check engine, ABS, or maintenance light on? Take the guesswork out of your warning lights with O'Reilly Veriscan. The service is free and provides a report with solutions verified by ASE-certified master technicians. And if you need help, we could recommend a shop for you. Ask for O'Reilly Veriscan today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Well, we've been told that we must support the proxy war against Russia because Ukraine is a democracy. That's what they tell us, that NATO and the Western world must support Ukraine's proxy war because we're fighting for democracy. We're fighting for freedom. But long before the war started, long before the CIA-backed coup in Ukraine, the Maidan coup, Ukraine was listed by the United States' own State Department as one of the most corrupt countries in Europe. We've covered that extensively here on the show. In fact, you can go to the U.S. State Department's own website and see it for yourself. So hardly a country that supported democratic principles. And many Western media publications talked about Ukraine's corruption openly. But then, when the war broke out, the media changed their tune. The propaganda by Western media and Western governments went into overdrive, basically trying to rewrite Ukraine's history. But today, we're lucky to have a former member of the French Ministry of Defense, Benoît Paré. He was an international observer of Ukraine before the war broke out. He was there. And he's written a book called What I Saw in Ukraine from 2015 to 2022. And we're very lucky to have Benoît joining us now to talk about his experiences in Ukraine and what he saw while he was there. He was one of the very few people with access to the very sensitive information that we never got to see about civilian victims, about human rights violations. The OSCE decided not to make that information public. And Benoît joins us now. Great to see you. Thank you so much for doing this.
Hi, great to see you, Clayton. Thank you so much for the invitation. I'm glad to be here.
My pleasure. Western governments, you know, insist that Ukraine is a democracy. It's worth defending at all costs. There's a new tranche of advanced fighter jets that Sweden has now signed a deal with Zelensky to send 150 new advanced fighter jets to continue this proxy war. I just spoke with the spokesperson for Vladimir Putin and the press office of Russia. And she told me the moment that those jets arrive in Ukraine, they will be destroyed. So this continues. But based on what you personally witnessed as an OSCE observer from 2015 to 2022, was Ukraine ever functioning as a true democracy? What did it look like? What did democracy look like to you on the ground in Ukraine?
Well, thank you, Clayton, for this question. It's spot on, I would say. If you allow me just a quick remark, I mean, also yesterday, the French president signed a letter of intention with President Zelensky to buy 100 Rafale fighter jets. So it's the same as the Gripen contract. It's like a copy paste. So it's going even further. When I was thinking of what to say for this interview, I thought one of the key messages I wanted to convey was to say that Ukraine before 2022 was far from being a model democracy. And this is just how you decided to start this conversation. So I think it's spot on. Now, why do I say that? It's because since 2014, we, the Western audiences, were basically lied to by our media, by our politicians, about what really happened back then on the Maidan Square, 2014. This is where this whole war started. This is when, you know, the elected president was considered pro-Russian, was basically chased out by violence, by an insurrection. And when you read the actually the studies that what was made by a university professor from the University of Ottawa in Canada, his name is Ivan Kachanovsky. Ivan Kachanovsky demonstrated in a massive work, which was 72 pages long, which I read while I was in Ukraine. He demonstrated that most of the victims that were allegedly killed by police that day, this is when it all started, were basically killed from positions held by the opposition parties. The opposition parties that were then to take power, right? So in other terms, this was a coup, right? This was a coup based on a false flag attack on demonstrators. Now, all the evidence is out there for people to look at, except that people don't want to look at it. I mean, when I say people, I mean the mainstream media. When I was in Ukraine, I was once interviewed by a journalist from the mainstream media. It was back in 2016. And back then I had just been introduced with this thesis by Ivan Kachanovsky on the Maidan massacre. And I basically explained to him, like I just explained to you, what it said, basically. And I said, well, don't you, as a journalist from a major media, aren't you interested in digging into it to see, you know, how credible the story is? And he just paused for 2 seconds and said, well, no, it would change too many things. That was his answer, right? And I'm talking about somebody who worked for the equivalent of a New York Times in America. This is kind of level of newspaper.
And what specifically were you asking him to look at? What specifically were you asking him to look at? The Maidan Square coup and the false flag attack? Is that what you were asking him to
study?
Yeah,
I was asking him to have a look into the thesis of this university professor, Ivan Kachanovsky, who is, by the way, Ukrainian from Western Ukraine originally. I just asked him to have a look at the 72 pages document that was available online, which basically demonstrated that this was a coup. Actually, back then, I had not read the whole document myself because I felt a bit intimidated by it back then. I just had just read the introduction and the conclusion. But just what he said was, like, you know, mind-blowing, right? So I thought it deserved to actually be studied carefully, thoroughly. That he just refused. Journalists just refused. So it was a demonstration to me that a major journalist representing a major media that all the other medias rely upon to see what should we say about what's going on in Ukraine. And this guy decided that it was not worth it. So I understood that mainstream media were not interested in the truth, right? That's the first point I wanted to make. That's why I'm saying we have been lied to since 2014. Because I was convinced about it myself when I finally read the whole thesis, and when I watched all the videos that were actually referred to in the in this document, because they were later on translated in English, and then I even had some of my interpreters with whom I was working with in Ukraine, I had them check the translation, the English subtitles of some of the key moments of these videos, and it was confirmed to me that the translations were correct, right? So, okay, that's why I thought these pieces of work is basically proof of what happened back then, right? So I would recommend people to check the work of this professor. He has an X account, which is very well documented. He has his own website. For anyone interested, I recommend first to look at it, because that basically gives you a different understanding of everything that happened since then. It basically tells you that the regime that took power from 2014 is illegitimate because it's based on a violent coup and on a false flag operation, something extremely cynical, because they actually decided to kill their own supporters, right? People who basically wanted not Milosevic, sorry, Yanukovych to be removed, right? And they actually sacrificed them. This is what it says. Now, moving on to my own experience as an OIC observer, I was working for this organization for between 2015 to 2022, as you mentioned. Now, I was lucky in a sense because from the very start, 2015, I was assigned to a specific unit within the OIC mission, which was called the Human Dimension. Now, as members of the Human Dimension, we had access to very sensitive information about civilian casualties and about human rights violations, as you mentioned. And we were just a small team, actually, having access to all that data. And from the very beginning, I discovered stories about people being kidnapped in the streets, in their homes, by people wearing balaclavas, which was basically some kind of faceless masks that the these people were wearing. And then they were taken into minivans and then were driven away at high speed. And nobody knew who they were. And the families were in panic, not understanding what's going on. And my colleagues at the OIC office in Kramatorsk back then were visited every second day by people who came to complain that their relatives had been kidnapped. Right. And so they decided to investigate.
So, Benoit, just so I understand. Yep. So you had a small office and this was you were a French contingent who was there from OSCE with your French compatriots or was it international?
It was international. Actually, when you work for the OSCE, you're basically pre-recruited by your own Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Because in my career, I worked for both.
Sorry, we were on a bit of a delay. People can forgive our little bit of a delay here, but technology, it's amazing. Can you explain what the OSCE is for our audience and this international group? Then you had an office set up there, and the Ukrainians, I guess, knew that you had an office there, and so they were coming to complain to you that their relatives had been just rounded up and thrown into minivans. But can you explain what OSCE is and what is their mission?
Sure. The OSCE stands for Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. It is an international organization based in Vienna, but it basically comprises all the countries from the Northern Hemisphere. Initially, it was created in 1975 as a conference meant to organize a dialogue between the Western Bloc and the Eastern Bloc, former Soviet Union. It's basically NATO countries talking to the former Warsaw Pact countries. This is how it was born, right? When the Soviet Union collapsed, it became the OSCE, Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, and it started to replace the UN, the United Nations, in various countries where there were deep crises. It started with just after the civil war in Bosnia and Herzegovina, so the first major OSCE mission abroad was in Bosnia and Herzegovina from 1996, just after the Dayton Agreement. So it's like a mini United Nations, if you will, right? So now, in order to work for the OSCE, member states basically select candidates within their own ranks. So, and you have to go through your own Ministry of Foreign Affairs, usually. In the US, it's the State Department. And they select people who then they present to the OSCE as candidates for various missions. This is how we were all recruited. So in the OSCE mission in Ukraine, it was called the Special Monitoring Mission in Ukraine. There were many Americans as well. There were also Russians. Basically, people from all over the Northern Hemisphere, as I said. And we were all working together, but not representing our own states. We were representing the OSCE as such, the OSCE as an independent entity, right? So this is how it was organized. But we were also, all of us, somehow, we were all paid to different degrees by our own member states, right? So we also, we had like two different bosses. We had our own member states as in the background, but our main boss was the OSCE. Okay. Now, then, when this mission deployed, one of its first tasks, actually, because we were deployed from 2014, March 2014. Our first task was to monitor the situation with human rights and to report on every security incident in a neutral manner. I insist on that. We were supposed to be neutral. And we were supposed to report on a regular basis about all these things that we would notice. And we had freedom of movement to go wherever we wanted to monitor the situation. And then when the Minsk agreement was signed, we were tasked within the Minsk agreement to also monitor the ceasefire violations and the withdrawal of heavy weapons. These were the two main tasks that were assigned to us, OAC Observer, within the framework of the Minsk agreements. But myself, I belong to this small unit within the OAC called Human Dimension, that was not actually, whose mandate was not part of the Minsk agreement as such. We were following the initial mandate from 2014, which required us to monitor human rights violations, basically. Right. So, and this is what I became specialized in.
Can I just ask you?
Yeah.
So you were specialized in this. You had this small office. You said you had freedom of movement, that you could go anywhere in the country to monitor these situations. How were you tipped off about these human rights violations? Was it through intelligence sources from your French Ministry of Defense? Was it just simply citizens in Ukraine who were knocking on your door saying, hey, my son was just kidnapped and thrown into a minivan? How did you come to capture these violations?
Well, as you mentioned, sometimes, many times actually at the beginning, it was just people knocking on our door at the office in Kramatorsk. This is how most of the stories my colleagues were exposed to. This is had happened. Just people knocking on the door. We call that walked-ins, when people would just walked in, right? I experienced that as well myself later on. But we were also reading the daily press, local press. So we got stories from the local press as well. Sometimes we had requests from our headquarters in Kyiv, but we didn't have a direct communication link with our home countries. We started to have a direct communication link from late 2015, at the initiative of France, by the way, my own country. And we started to have like regular meetings with the French embassy as well, for the French people, but Americans did the same with their own embassy, the Brits, the Russians, and so forth. But that was happening about twice a year on average.
So just to be clear, the Americans, the French, the British, all of you were receiving separate human rights violations reports, kidnappings, all of these things. So all of these countries were receiving this information, not just France and your contingent.
Yes and no, because all these human rights violations were treated as a sensitive matter. So every time somebody walked in with an issue which was considered to be a possible human rights violation, they were sent to us, the Human Dimension Unit. And we were supposed to treat those information as sensitive, meaning not necessarily for everyone to know. Because oftentimes, people were threatened or were afraid to be threatened. In order to protect them, we had to assess whether to make the information public or not, whether to write reports about it or not. We had different reporting systems. Our whole mission was a gigantic report mechanism. Our main mission was to write reports about what was going on the ground. But our unit, Human Dimension Unit, we had two separate channels of communication. There was some information we were actually feeding into the main communication channels, but the most sensitive stories, we were not actually communicating them through these means. We had like a separate, almost secret channel in which we would actually collect the most sensitive information. And it is that information that only very few people knew about, myself, among others, that 90% of my colleagues had no clue of the type of information I and other colleagues were collecting, because of our the way we functioned. This confidentiality was
this is a very sensitive
to protect the people. protect the victims.
Guys, look at me. You know what I'm wearing? It's the bearskin hoodie. You guys know all about this, right? Well, if you've been waiting to get one for yourself, now is the time. It's officially hoodie season. Cold mornings, windy days, surprise snow. And right now, Bearskin is running their biggest deal of the year. We're talking 60% off for this Black Friday and Cyber Monday. Now, this isn't some old fleece. This thing is built with 340 GSM. Bearskin fleece, 10 pockets, and rugged athletic fit that actually looks good on you. Plus, if it starts pouring, you can just zip on that heavy storm rain jacket and instantly level up to full waterproof protection. I wear this thing every morning when I'm walking the dog and every night now that the nights are pretty darn cold as well. And I got stuck in a big hailstorm just not too long ago, and I had my storm rain jacket over top, right over top of my bearskin hoodie, and I was totally dry. You're going to get free U.S. shipping from their U.S. warehouse and gear that'll last you season after season. So here's what you need to do to get that 60% off. Just text the word redacted to 36912. Again, that's redacted to 36912. They'll text you a link so you can lock in your 60% off before that sale disappears. Don't wait till this weather gets really bad. Grab a bearskin right now while this Black Friday deal is live. And one more thing, when you support Bearskin, you're also supporting the Fallen Outdoors and the Hope for the Warriors Veterans Program. So you're not just buying great gear, you're also backing a cause that matters. So grab your bearskin while this Black Friday deal is still live. Text the word redacted to 36912. What does a US dollar get you these days? Because it's being continually devalued, thanks to the Federal Reserve, which is a large criminal organization that just basically prints money, devalues our currency. It's one giant cabal, of course. The reason that we have a Fed, of course, is to continue to carry out wars around the world. And they don't want us owning gold. They moved us off of a gold standard. But that's why Natalie and I invest in gold and silver as a way to protect our family. Yes, it's great that it's skyrocketed in value. I love that gold has gone. When we started buying, it was around $1,700 an ounce. It's now over $4,000 an ounce. That's wonderful. But that's not why we do it. We do it actually to protect our family. Think of it like a lockbox where you take US dollars and you convert them to gold or silver, and it's sustained for 5,000 years. Every government currency in world history has collapsed. Yes, indeed, it has. So now is a chance for you to get access to gold and silver and start doing this for your family. Reach out to our friends at Lear Capital. That's who we use. You can have gold or silver shipped right to your house. You can store it in your gun safe, or you can store it offsite in a guarded facility. Totally up to you. They will walk you through that process. They're a fantastic American company. And the best part is they want you to develop a relationship with you just by getting on the phone with them. There's no pressure. The first time we ever started working with them before they were on our show, we just called them. We had a great conversation with them and we moved through the process with them. They held our hand the entire way, and that's what they will do for you. So call them 1-800-613-3557 and you can ask for their free gold guide. They'll ship it right to your house. You can sit down with your loved ones and talk about, hey, how can we start moving some US dollars into precious metals to protect our family? And they'll walk you through that process. Or just go to the website learredacted.com. And guess what? You can receive up to $15,000 in free bonus metals with a qualified purchase. Once again, that's learredacted.com. That is the place to go. Very sensitive, I guess, as you've described it. You said Ukraine was a scary country. So when you had access to this very sensitive information, can you give our audience a sense of a few examples of what, how sensitive this information was?
Initially, the first person I interviewed myself who had a story to sell was a journalist from the Donbass, but he was working on the Ukrainian-controlled part of the Donbass. You know, the Donbass was divided in two since 2014. So initially, I was working in the Ukrainian-controlled part, and then I moved on to the separatist-controlled part, but I could see, you know, both sides. Now, on the Ukrainian-controlled part, I talked to this journalist who claimed he was kidnapped, as I mentioned earlier, in the street by people wearing these balaclavas, and then he was driven away in a van far away, and then he was kept in a basement for 3 days with a hood on his head, which was almost never taken off, and he was subject to torture, interrogation, humiliations. He didn't want to describe the type of torture that was inflicted upon him, but we could guess it was of a sexual nature because he was basically stripped naked on a chair for 3 days with just a t-shirt and a hood on his face. and his hand tied behind him. This is how he was treated for 3 days. Now, he told us the people who took him were what was called a voluntary battalion in those days. You know, from 2014, the Ukrainian government decided to form so-called voluntary battalions. Azov was part of them. This is how Azov was born. But you also had other battalions named like Donbas Battalion. Others were named Aida Battalion, Dnipro 1, Dnipro 2 battalions. And I heard so many stories about people being snatched, kidnapped by these people and tortured. Now, because then I moved on to Mariupol and I got similar stories in Mariupol from other people, other journalists. So journalists were one of the key targets for them because they didn't want, you know, a counter narrative to emerge, right? So they were targeting journalists on a priority basis. And I personally talked to 5 or 6 different journalists. It's all in my book. Actually, there's one testimony I couldn't write about in my book because it was too sensitive, because the person who was accused of torturing the guy was a famous figure in Ukraine. The journalist asked me not to reveal the details. So, and that was the worst story of all.
Can you just tell me where, so it's in your book.
Yeah.
Can you tell me where these journalists were from? A sampling? Were they from many different countries?
Ukrainians. They were local Ukrainian
journalists.
Local Ukrainian journalists.
What specifically they were covering, what topics specifically? Were they covering stories about human rights abuses and the coup and what was actually happening? And they were trying to be silenced? Can you?
One journalist, for instance, basically said that at the beginning of the conflict, the Ukrainian military was shelling different cities, like shelling Slavyansk, Kramatorsk. Yes. So one journalist wrote about that, and he said that this is why he was kidnapped afterwards, because they said, you cannot write that. But he said, but that's the truth. My job is to write the truth. My job is to write facts. And he was told, no, you cannot write such things. And he was even blackmailed. They asked him to, at some point, to hold a gun in his hand. So he did. And then they said, okay, now we have your fingertips. We have your fingerprints on a gun. If you don't do as you're told, we will basically accuse you of terrorism, right? And I have other people, other journalists who told me that the SBU, it was not the voluntary battalions in this case, it was the SBU, the Secret Service of Ukraine, that basically told them, you have to stop working as a journalist. If you don't, we'll put you in jail for 8 years. We'll put a file against you. Two different journalists told me that from Mariupol, both of them from Mariupol. There is even one of these guys who actually died in detention. His name is in the book. I don't recall it right now, but even Amnesty International back then, you know, even wrote about him, but now it's totally forgotten. His main fault, if I may say, he was the leader of a newspaper called I Want USSR. Right. So he was, his newspaper was a major target. So that guy was kidnapped very early on from June 2014 and then never seen again, even though the SBU at some point acknowledged that they actually held him in detention. And then they said, oh, we don't know where he is. And everybody believes he died in detention. Again, the details are in my book. I even had colleagues who talked to the chief of police of Mariupol about the case of this guy back then. Even the chief of police actually confirmed that SBU was actually holding this guy in custody. But then the SBU denied, and the guy was never seen again. And his wife said that she met somebody at some point who also was in detention at some point, and who said he actually saw her husband being detained and being looking extremely tired, and then he was never heard of again, right? So other people I talked to were tortured. They witnessed other people around them being tortured. And then I attended court hearings because, you know, the Human Dimension Unit, we started to attend court hearings in related, what we call conflict-related cases. I started to attend court cases in Kramatorsk, then in Slavyansk, and then in Bakhmut, and then most of them attended in Mariupol. So in all the cities that were controlled by the Ukrainian government, all the Donbas cities controlled by the Ukrainian government. And they kept arresting people. And when you went to these court hearings, you could see anybody could be arrested, not just journalists, like average people. You know, if you were caught talking about a military position of the Ukrainian military somewhere, you know, just like down the street where you live, if you were caught talking about that on the phone, you would be arrested and you would be charged for revealing positions of the Ukrainian military. And that was considered to be a crime, especially if you were talking to people who were living on the other side of Donbass. And in Donbass, actually, people had relatives everywhere. You know, most families had relatives on the other side. So, of course, they would talk to them, you know, about what was going on. They would talk to their friends. And in court hearings, you realize that it was just, they would just like drag people who were talking to their friends or family members on the other side and just discussing about the general situation and say, oh, you know what, you know, the school over there that we went to, but now it's occupied by the military. Oh, really? Yes. And then the SBU listens to that and says, oh, you revealed a military position to somebody based on the other side. So it's giving intelligence to the enemy. We'll cut you. And then from the moment the trial started, there was no way they could escape the condemnation. They were all of them, I'm talking about thousands of cases, all of them were sentenced in both the Donetsk and Lugansk Oblast. I got statistics from the office of the prosecutor in both oblasts of Donetsk and Lugansk. I personally met the teams of prosecutors with some of my colleagues in both oblasts. And they gave us the figures of how many people they actually arrested, how many people they convicted, and so forth, and how many people were yet to be convicted. And in both cases, prosecutors told me, oh, you know what, we have only one or two people who actually escaped conviction in the first instant court. But, okay, don't worry, they will be convicted in appeal, there's no doubt. And there was a 100% conviction rate of all these people whose trial started. I mean, this is a conviction rate.
What were the charges?
What were the charges?
I mean, what were the charges? Because as to my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, under the 1996 constitution in Ukraine, after the separation from the Soviet Union, they have in their constitution under Article 34, freedom of thought, freedom of speech, but I think as the government has laid claim, from my understanding, is that in situations where the Ukrainian government says that this is a this could hurt national security, then your freedom of speech goes out the window. So what charges were these people charged with that wound them up in prison for the rest of their life or killed?
Well, there were basically four or five different articles of the penal code. Criminal code that were used against them. Now you talk about freedom of speech, actually. Well, freedom of speech is allowed, but in certain cases it is not. For instance, Article 110 of the Criminal Code of Ukraine actually prevents people from publicly calling for a change of the borders of a country. Right? So if you're caught doing a Facebook post, which happened, there was one trial we attended of two young guys. They were like less than 20 years old. They actually posted statements in favor of DPR, the DPR, which was like the Donetsk People's Republic, separatist entity. So in other terms, that is calling for a change of the border of Ukraine. And that's actually falls under Article 110, public call for changing the borders of Ukraine. So you're not allowed in Ukraine to actually revendicate any separatist ambition. It's not allowed in public speech. Now, in a country like mine, France, in a country like the UK, or in a country like Canada, it is allowed, if you live in Quebec, to talk about Quebec independence. You know, in Quebec, they had like a couple of referendums on the topic, but it's considered part of democratic debate. In the UK, as we all know, they had even a referendum on like not changing the borders. Actually, yes, they had one referendum about Scotland's independence, if you remember, some years ago, just changing right. The borders of the state. In France, you know, there has been you know talks about the independence of Corsica, for instance, for decades. Now, but you know, we even have members of an independentist party elected in parliament. It's completely allowed to talk about it. Right, as long as it remains.
Yeah, in the United States, in the United States, where we are actively trying to have California removed from the United States. We can talk about it openly. Yeah. You know?
So you could say mature democracies actually don't have problems about talking about these issues, right? But Ukraine does not allow conversation about such topics. Actually, it basically shows that the people who actually conceived this criminal code were afraid of opening some kind of Pandora's box, because they knew that their state was fragile. Because when you look at Ukraine, it's a very young state. It never existed as an independent state until the collapse of the Soviet Union, actually, except for maybe a couple of years, you know, at the end of World War One. But even then, you know, it was not exactly the same state. It was never really functional. In Ukraine, you have people from Western Ukraine, Eastern Ukraine, who speak different languages, have completely different histories, different aspirations. So they were aware of that from the very start. And that's why they wanted to prevent any public speech talking about change of borders, because they were very much afraid of it. That, you know, at some point, you cannot actually prevent people from talking about their true aspirations. You know, it cannot last forever. So this is one of the reasons why I consider Ukraine was not a real democracy from very early on, because some basic freedoms that we have in the West, they didn't have those. You couldn't talk about changing the borders of a state. That was one thing. Now, the article under which most people were sued was Article 358 of the Criminal Code, which was about terrorism. They used article about terrorism to go after everyone who actually exchanged information about military positions of Ukraine with friends or relatives. Or sometimes it could be actually real people who were collecting intelligence on the side of the DPR. I think in some cases it was indeed the case from the evidence I saw in court. But they actually mixed, you know, some case you could consider legitimate with case which were obviously just people talking to their families and or friends and nothing more than that. But anyways, they were arresting all these people as like to make a point, you know, we don't allow you to talk about military positions. So what we realized is that from the moment the trial started, there was no way back, there was no way out. And worse than that, in half of the cases I personally followed, me and my colleagues, and I'm talking about 30 different cases that I followed altogether, in half of the cases, I counted once, I made statistics, people complained in court that they were tortured while they were interrogated or just after arrest, or just upon their arrest. Some of these people were arrested in some very violent
manners. By the SBU or prison? By the SBU?
Both the SBU and the volunteer battalions, both. Right. Mostly volunteer battalions in 2014, but also by the SBU. Like there was one former chief of police, I remember, from Volnovakha, which is a town in Donbass. He described how he was arrested, like SBU people burst into his home, beat him up, beat his wife up as well, to the point he thought he was going to die, and his wife thought he was going to die as well. But it was like a tactic to, like, you know, shock them, impress them so that they would confess whatever. I heard different stories that were similar. People were basically beaten up from the very moment they were arrested in order to create a shock and in order to have them disoriented and confess whatever, you know. And then once you actually manage to confess, to make people confess whatever you want them to say, then you just have confessions which you present in court as being legitimate. But then these people would say, oh, sorry, this is not legitimate. I was forced to say this, you know, and I heard that personally in court in various cases. I heard the testimonies of people telling these stories. So, you know, from the body language and the tone of the voice and stuff, we also talked to the defense lawyers, family members. I had no doubt that these people were telling the truth. You know, you can tell when people are lying. And these people were not lying. In some cases, we even had medical certificates. Because what they did sometimes, sorry, just to quickly to describe this kind of method they were using. They would first grab people in the street or in their homes, bring them to a basement somewhere for a couple of days, beat them up, scare them like hell, make them sign blank papers, and then release them. And they were released in the street, didn't know where they were. And 1 hour later, they were actually officially arrested and then charged. And then they would use the blank papers they had signed previously, and they would put a text upon this paper and present it as evidence of confession. Now, I had this story basically described in court in Kramatorsk. I heard it. And it was also reported by some of my colleagues in reports that I read, which they wrote before me. So I realized, okay, it's a modus operandi that they were following, right? And this is the country that we are told is like the defense of democracy. You know, what happened in those days in Donbass was worthy of the worst dictatorships. But who knows about it? Nobody knows about it because it was completely kept under the rug. The media would not report about it because the journalists themselves were intimidated. And in our case, we were told, oh, this is sensitive, we cannot report about it. So this never appeared in our reports. We were just actually feeding the United Nations Human Rights Monitoring Mission that was present as well with some of the information because they dared to report a bit more than we did. But only a fraction of information about all these cases came out. And it was just the tip of the iceberg. Now, this is not to say that the separatists on their side also committed violence against people. In some cases, you know, we had information about that as well. But what I find worrying is that we decided to support one side, which was considered the side of good, the side that defends democracy. Then it does not defend democracy. I've seen it firsthand. And as you mentioned, what I saw scared me for years. And I witnessed this for years in court. And I thought at some point that I have to put this on the table. People need to know this. They need to know that we're on the edge of World War III to defend this state that committed such crimes against its own citizens.
The judiciary, the judges, it seems like with 100% conviction rate that they are really in the pockets of the corrupt government. In your experience, would you say that that's the case? Can you describe the judges and the judiciary that was so willing to just lock these people up and look the other way with 100% conviction rate?
Yeah, I mean, it was obvious in Donbass. I can't tell about every single region of Ukraine, but in Donbass, it was obvious. Even one of my colleagues at some point, he talked to one of the judges. He interviewed one judge. And at some point, he put his pen away and said, okay, now I just have a question for you. I'm not writing the answer down. So it's between you and me. Now, tell me, in simple words, how does your justice system function here? And the guy said, well, it's very simple. The prosecutor asks, and we follow. Basically, this is how trials were going on in Donbass. Systematically.
So no defense.
No. The judges were following
defense
whatever.
Defense is irrelevant here.
The judges were following whatever the prosecutors would say. Right. And, you know, some other people said, well, basically the courts in Donbass were completely under the control of SBU. And it was obvious in some cases. You know, at some point I was witnessing a pretty high profile trial in Kramatorsk. And at some point I see one guy who actually films everyone, including myself. And then I asked, well, who is this guy who's filming me? He has no media sign. So, you know, I was wondering, who is this? And I was told he's representing the SBU. So the SBU was filming everyone who attended the court hearings. And then I know also, because it was like reported to me by family members, that then they would visit all the people who would attend the hearing, visit in their homes and say, why do you attend the hearing of this traitor? You're going to be in trouble if you continue to attend the hearing. Are you sure you want to create troubles for yourself? This was reporting back to me by family members of the defendant in this case. And in this case, it was like a small town mayor. So they were intimidating everyone. The SBU was running the show. And one lawyer also said that, but anyways, the courts in Donbass are controlled by the EU. No, the whole operation, they call it the anti-terrorist operation, ATO. It was run by the SBU. It was not the military that was running operations in Donbass, counterinsurgency operations, you could say, in Donbass. It was the SBU directly until 2018. And from 2018, they actually transferred authority to the military. But before, it was the Secret Service, the SBU, that was totally in charge, including of the armed forces. They were controlling everything. And at some point, we were I was personally called by, we had a secret call, a secret meeting in a town in Donbass. And I didn't really know what it was about. They didn't want to tell us. And then I arrived there, I realized it was the group of local journalists who were like panicking because they knew the SBU was investigating them. And they knew that if a trial started, it would be already over, because with a 100% condition rate, once the trial starts, there's no way back, right? So they wanted to prevent the trials to start. That's why they contacted me as OSCE representative to raise their case with us, the OSCE. And then I realized talking to them that they were not only targeting the journalist in this case, but also the mayor of the town. It was a relatively big town in this case. And I interviewed him, and I could see he was panicking. He was afraid because he knew that, you know, he would also be put into jail, you know, if he has been wanted. And there were cases like the mayor of Slavyansk. It's a pretty big city of 100,000 people. And Slavyansk was taken by separatists very early on in the conflict. And she was put in jail very early on for 3 years. Her trial lasted for 4 years. In the end, she was released. She was one of the very few people who managed to be released. But because she was like a pretty high profile figure. So, she managed. But there are many other people who never managed to escape because they were small people. They were not important enough. So the judicial system in Ukraine was really scary. And then I discovered that it was not only in Donbass that it was problematic, because then I moved to Odessa at the end of my stay in Ukraine. And then I heard stories about what was going on in Odessa that was mind-blowing. You know, in Odessa on 2nd of May 2014, there was what we call the Odessa massacre, when about between 40 and 50 pro-Russian supporters were basically burned alive or beaten to death in a building in and around a building in Odessa, right? It's a famous case in Ukraine. And then there were mass trials after that, because it basically started with, after there were some brawls in the city between the pro-Ukrainian and the pro-Russian people. So they arrested people on both sides, but the only people who were later convicted were pro-Russian people. The pro-Ukrainian people were never convicted of anything. And they were not even put into custody. Only the pro-Russian people were put into custody. They didn't do that with the others. Or when it happened, it was only like short periods. So, and I know a person of a case, a guy, Sergei Hodiak, whom I actually saw with my own eyes in the street in 2022, on 20th of February in Odessa. He was participating in a demonstration against Russia. And the guy was actually still indicted officially for murder after the Odessa event, but he was just walking free. And my colleagues told me, you know, when his trial started, his colleagues, usually former military guys, they basically came to the court and physically removed him from the court and told the court, you know, you will not judge this guy. He's a patriot. And this court is illegitimate to judge a patriot. So we're taking him out. And that's it. That's the end. And the trial never resumed. You know, that was the end of it. This is the justice system Ukraine way. So this was told to me by my colleagues when I came in Odessa. And then one interpreter basically showed me the guy in the street, and I could see herself. She was shocked. She was still under shock. And when I was in Kramatorsk, also during a trial, you know, one guy who was like a small mayor, he was basically set up by the SBU. He had the proof. He was blackmailed before he was arrested. They asked him to give money. Said, you should give money to a certain account or you will be in trouble. And he didn't want to give money. He didn't want to basically obey this blackmail. And he was arrested 1 week later, and then he was put in jail, right? And but he had contacts in the local police, and actually he showed them the phone number that was blackmailing him. He said, well, this is a phone number, but it's blackmailing me. Who is behind it? And the local police told him, that's the SBU. And he said that in court, right? But then during...
I know separately from our own sources here at Redacted how, you know, obviously how corrupt the SBU is, and targeting of journalists, targeting of civilians, the illegal arresting of civilians and locking them up. Of the journalists you've been talking about and the people that have been arrested, thrown, and tortured by the SBU, those are all Ukrainians, right? Do you have instances where these were international journalists, United States journalists, others who were also caught up in the SBU's net?
I never heard stories about international journalists being caught up and tortured like this. I never heard such stories. I think they were cautious enough not to target internationals. But actually that...
Except former friend of the show, Gonzalo Lira.
Yeah.
Who...
Except him.
Yeah. Is the United States and a friend. And I, you know, I've had him on the show. I've been on his show, and he was, of course, tortured and beaten up by the SBU. He wasn't really allowed to talk about it. He was thrown behind bars and then released. And then I think it's up to speculation, but sort of made to look like he was running for the border, trying to get away, but was really being used in many ways as like a honeypot to try to capture other journalists and to be caught up by the SBU. And then he was killed in prison, arguably by the SBU. And there was really no international outrage from the United States at all. The Biden administration did nothing about it. A United States, a U.S. citizen, journalist, killed by the SBU.
Yes, I'm well aware about this case of Gonzalo Lira, but it was after I left Ukraine. So I was basically thinking about the time when I was there. And also, I mean, he was, alone. He was independent. He didn't work for a media outlet, right? So he had nobody to protect him, unfortunately, you know. And I was familiar with his work before he was arrested, actually, because I was following his YouTube videos pretty closely before that. And I'm well aware of his case because I read the Twitter feed that he basically published before being arrested for the second time, where he gave all the details about how he was set up and tortured in prison. And that actually his story, then I could actually see how it fitted into other testimonies I myself collected from other people who were put in jail in Ukraine. So, and I could see this is coherent, basically. So, I mean, the judicial system.
Yeah. Were you ever intimidated? Did they ever come? Here you are and your group, you're going around and you're getting this information. You're getting this sensitive information. The SBU clearly knew what you were up to. Were you ever confronted by them? Were you ever told to not do what you were doing?
When I was in Ukraine, you know, they knew we were there in court. At the beginning, you know, as we were told, it seemed that the judges kind of tried to behave better. That's what local people told us, right? So they were happy when they were there, but quickly then they realized that we wouldn't make any difference. They realized we were no threat because we didn't have the power to tell them what to do. We were just observers, right? We didn't have the power to tell the courts what to do, how to do their job. So they realized we were harmless in this sense. And also since, you know, nothing came out in official reports, it's okay, we see it's harmless. So, you know, they had no need to threaten us in this case. So that's how this is what happened. Now, there's also another type of information we were collecting in the field, which is very important. The information about civilian casualties of acts of war, basically, shelling, shooting. From 2016, we in the OSCE Human Dimension Unit started to systematically try to verify every allegation of civilian victims on both sides of the line of contact. And at the end of the year, people in our mission, in our human dimension unit, decided to release a report, which was a statistical report of all the victims whose stories we had verified, and that made like a special report for the whole year 2016. Now, our management was afraid of this report because they knew it was like highly sensitive. They asked several edits, and eventually it was released in September of 2017. But when it was released, and I'm not sure to what extent the report was public, to be honest, but at least it was shown to the delegations of UAC, the delegations of the member states. And the Ukrainian delegation, Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Ukraine, made a scandal when this report was published. Why? Because on page 7, it was stated that 63% of the victims we verified were basically living on the Ukrainian side, Ukrainian-controlled side of Donbas, which, the other way around. They were living on the separatist-controlled side of Donbas, meaning when that, you know, Ukraine was responsible for the injuries, right, logically. So they made a scandal because we published that. But even this figure actually was mixing all kinds of reasons for causes for injuries, because we're mixing shelling with people who are working on mines and booby traps. And when you work on mine booby traps, you cannot really actually say this, you cannot really blame one side or the other, especially when this happens in the gray zone, you know, in between the sides controlled by the different parties. So we had mixed all the data. But then, to finish the story about this report. So our head of mission, because of a Ukrainian reaction, decided that from then on, we would no longer publish statistics that would show on which side we would actually confirm the most, the biggest amount of victims. Our head of mission decided, okay, we no longer report upon this.
So Ukrainian government requested that you no longer publish that information.
They made a scandal about it, and my head of mission said, all right, fine, we won't publish these figures anymore, right? But actually, I was myself then continuing to work, we were all continuing to work on the verification of the civilian casualties throughout Donbas. I was part of that. And at the beginning, I was working in the Donetsk Oblast, right? And at some point, I had access to the database of the whole oblast. And it was the oblast out of the two oblasts in Donbas that had the biggest amount of victims by far. And in the area where I was working back then, it was Mariupol, I noticed the percentage of victims on the separatist side was huge compared to the side controlled by Ukraine. It was 90% of the victims in our case were on the separatist controlled side. And I said, well, there's something massive here. You know, and then I was wondering, how is it in other areas like Donetsk surroundings and the northern part of the oblast around Kramatorsk? And I noticed that the trends were more or less similar. And then I did statistics for the whole oblast, and I showed it to my colleagues. I said, we have something here. Because if you consider not only, you know, like all the causes of injuries, but only those we call the continuation of the acts of war, like shelling and shooting, the discrepancy, the imbalance between the sides is even worse. And I noticed that then I even got data from the Luhansk Oblast, because I was assigned there at the turn between 2018 and 19. So I had access to the database of Luhansk Oblast, and then I had a database of victims of the whole of Donbas. I made statistics about that. And the statistics showed between 2016 to 2018, 72% of the victims that we verified were actually based on the separatist side of the line of contact, meaning caused by Ukrainian armed forces in most cases. And when we had doubts about who was responsible for the actual cause of injury, I was putting that in a different category, right? Because in some cases, like which I could, cases I personally investigated on the Ukrainian control side, some victims found on the Ukrainian control side were, I believe, shot at by Ukrainian forces, not separatist forces. You know, when people are injured by bullets of assault rifle, when they live, 3 kilometers away from a lot of contact, there's a little chance that they are actually injured by a bullet coming from the other side. right? And when you investigate behind it, then you find lots of testimonies of people who say, yes, there was shooting that day, very close, 200 meters away, right? So this is how you could guess, okay, so it was Ukrainian troops right. shooting here, not separatist troops. But even when there were like cases like, okay, you're not sure where to put them, I would put them in the box of gray zone. So even when I eliminated those strange cases, I still had this huge discrepancy statistics. And I decided we need to communicate on that because the general public in Ukraine believed what their own media were telling them, which was that they were basically aggressed, attacked every day by pro-Russian separatists, and that the Ukrainian military was not doing anything, just sitting there waiting to be shot at, right? And even President Poroshenko back then in 2018 was saying, you know, we have 10,000 people dead in Donbass back then. He said, everything is Russia's fault, you know, and we will never forget that, you know, Russia is responsible for 10,000 victims in Donbass. But when I look at the figures and I see, wait a minute, victims of Russia, are you sure? We have statistics that tend to show otherwise. But you know, the general public in the West also.
Most people don't know that. And
believed in that.
Right. And it was lied, covered up and believed that Russia was attacking their own Russian citizens in this separatist region. By all accounts, it was a genocide. I mean, 14, 15,000 people, many of them, as you pointed out, civilians, children on their way to school, bombings in parks. Friend of the show and great journalist Eva Bartlett, who's covered, you know, the petal mine launching, these small sort of like leaf-like petal mines that are just launched into parks. Kids pick them up and they're just killed instantly or their hands are blown off. Launched on a regular basis. People who have lived there talk about the trajectory of these shells coming in from the Ukrainian direction. And of course, ignored by the Western media, I would say across the board.
Yeah, I mean, I would maybe not use the term genocide, because I think it's a very strong word. It's debatable, let's say. At least, I mean, what I personally verified.
Ethnic cleansing? I mean, the intentional targeting of Russian.
I believe, for sure, you know, I verified it also. For the West, Ukrainian nationalists, the Donbass people are all traitors, you know, separatists. And they despise them, you know, because it's not only about victims, but we had so many testimonies about, you know, there were checkpoints all around Donbass, military checkpoints and police checkpoints, National Guard checkpoints all over the place, so especially near the line of contact. So local inhabitants who had to move in and out for various reasons, they were harassed on a regular basis at these checkpoints. We knew it. We collected testimonies about it every single day. All around Donbass. So it was not just, you know, causing injuries. It was the daily humiliation. And in so many different places, local inhabitants hated the Ukrainian armed forces. And if there was an armed forces that they considered occupiers, it was not Russian armed military or the separatists. It was the Ukrainian military that were obviously considered by so many people as forces of occupation. It was blatant in the testimonies we were collecting. And again, there's so many examples of that in my book. You know, things we were collecting on a daily basis, but actually such statements were considered non-factual by hierarchy, so they never made it into reports. So it always stayed at the local level. You know, the real atmosphere, the atmospherics about how people felt, that was considered non-factual by the OAC.
I want to tell you about our friends over at Bright Core Nutrition because, hey, have you tried their new kimchi pill? Well, the reason that they invented it is several reasons, but one is to help you fight microplastics, which are in every part of our lives. Scientists now estimate that we consume a credit card's worth of plastic every week through our food, our water, our tea bags even. One study found microplastics in human lungs. No one is safe from exposure. And plastics don't just sit in your body. They cross
the gut lining and leach into your blood, disrupt everything. They've been shown to alter gut bacteria. They are also an endocrine disruptor, which means they're messing with your hormones. So again, even if you eat clean or avoid packaged food, you're still exposed. You really can't opt out. But your gut can fight back with Kimchi One from Brightcore Nutrition. It is a potent ally in this toxic world. It is packed with over 900 probiotic strains unique to kimchi and proven to break down BPA, helping you detox from the inside out. It doesn't just support digestion, it helps protect your cells, your brains, your one brain. You probably have one brain. Your hormones and your future. Your body was never designed to handle plastics, but your gut was designed to help protect you. You just have to give it the right tools. So right now you can get 25% off with our code redacted at the link below. It's mybrightcore.com/redacted. Or you can call. You can call and get even 50% off plus free shipping. The number is there, 888-404-6312. You might get a better deal if you call, but if you'd like, either way, mybrightcore.com/redacted for their great Kimchi One. mybrightcore.com/redacted.
What if the medicine that helped save millions during the pandemic was being made mostly in China today? It's true, about 58% of the world's ivermectin supply comes from China, 75% from Asia overall, but not the wellness companies. Introducing American-made ivermectin, safe, trusted, and produced right here in the United States. Now, ivermectin has been prescribed globally for more than 30 years, even earned the Nobel Prize for medicine for its proven ability to eliminate parasites and support overall health. Well, new research also points to potential benefits for your skin, immune system, and cancer support. Most pharmacies charge $5 a tablet, but the wellness company is offering a higher 18-milligram dose for just $3 each. You'll get a 6-month supply designed for 4 21-day cleanse cycles at an unbeatable price. So support American medicine, not China's supply chain. Get your USA-made ivermectin today. Go to twc.health/redacted. Use the code redacted to save $30 off plus free shipping. Yeah, can I just ask you from a French government perspective? I mean, you were there on the behest of the French Ministry of Defense. The EU, of course, you know, a huge part of this a proxy war against Russia, France, the UK, the United States, Germany. Did you get any pushback from your own government when you were reporting this information?
Actually, when I made the statistics myself that I just mentioned, 2016, 2018, 72% of victims on the separatist control side, I wrote to my hierarchy within the OSCE to say this is too important to hide. We should communicate about this because it contributes to letting the propaganda being unchallenged. Our mission is to report facts. This is a major fact, and we're keeping it silent. And I was told, oh, yeah, but, you know, we actually report on individual cases on a daily basis. But, you know, who actually makes statistics on their own? Maybe people in embassies or in ministries of defense here or there, but it was never talked about on the public square. You know, it was so considered it was hidden. And we had the power to attract attention of the entire world about the real situation on the ground. And I consider it was a mandate to report on the reality on the ground. And that's why I tried to convince my hierarchy, we should communicate about the statistics. It's important if we really want to work for truth and peace, we have to communicate about that. Then the Ukrainian people realize, hey, wait a minute, actually, the separatists we consider as aggressors, they are more victims than we are. So, okay, maybe what we are told is not the reality. So maybe we should sit down and talk and stop this madness, stop killing each other. But I basically use these arguments in the memos I sent to my hierarchy saying this is why we have to communicate upon these things, to stop the dynamics of hatred and the dynamics of war. Because, you know, many people in Ukraine would support the war because of a false narrative. And not only in Ukraine, but in the Western world. And, but, you know, they treated me with silence. And then I decided, okay, I wrote to even to the head of the OSCE organization, who was then the Minister of Foreign Affairs of Italy, because, you know, OSCE has a presidency that's rotating every year. And that yet, but yet was Italy. I didn't get an answer. And then I decided to knock on the door of my own government. I basically went to my embassy and I told them, because this is the reality, this is the figures. And they listened to me politely, okay, fine. But nothing changed. And then even once when I was in Paris, I tried to talk to a diplomat I knew about the situation. And, same thing. He said, no, they thought that there was no reason to communicate upon that. And, France was one of the godfathers of the Minsk Agreement, like Germany. So I thought we had a specific responsibility to communicate about the reality on the ground. I initially thought France was the neutral power in this case because of our role in the Minsk Agreement. But, as year passed by as I was also bringing information that was accusing Ukraine of causing so much trouble, and I never heard any statement from my own government condemning Ukraine. Only once somebody told me this is a country that's been invaded, so, you have to understand them. What? They didn't want to react upon it. But for me, I was working for an organization which stated that we have to be neutral. I didn't see any reason to hide the truth of the reality on the ground. For me, that was a betrayal of our mandate. And that was a betrayal to all the citizens who pay their taxes to pay people like us, right? So, I got paid by U.S. citizens at some point, because when you look at who pays the OSCE budget, well, it's all the member states, including the U.S., or my government, right? It was a collective budget. So part of the money I earned was paid by the U.S. taxpayers. So, and we collectively decided, okay, no, this is too sensitive information to release, so we will not release it. So I consider that we betrayed our mandate. So this is why I thought, okay, now that we're on the edge of World War III, I want to talk about this. I want to put this on the table, even if that means, okay, I will never work again for my government, for sure, because they won't forgive me for this. But I thought it was a duty, a moral duty. Then I was ready to assume the total change of my life testifying about this. But I think it's too important.
No, and thank you for doing that. Thank you for coming forward with this. When we talk about the principles of democracy, right, we're talking about an independent judiciary separate from an executive branch, separate from a Congress, that they are free to carry out and adjudicate the laws and actually make sure that people are punished or set free based on that process. Freedom of speech, freedom of the press. So I'm just kind of running down all of the ways in which I view democracy, here in the United States. Freedom of religion, freedom to practice that religion without the government stepping in and closing churches or arresting priests, killing of priests, killing of journalists, suppressing free speech, disallowing what you're looking at online. An open judiciary that follows the letter of the law. So given all of those points, would you say that Ukraine is a democracy?
As you mentioned, I think it gradually drifted into a dictatorship. Now I would say it's almost a full-blown dictatorship as of now, because the mandate of the president expired long ago. They forbid 11 political parties. And actually, talking about opposition political parties, while I was there, they were constantly harassing the opposition bloc, which was like the main considered pro-Russian party, even though they would never say publicly they were pro-Russian. But the fact that they were in favor of a Minsk agreement labeled them as pro-Russian, because they were also in favor of the freedom of the Russian language. And just because they were supporting the Russian language, they were labeled pro-Russian. And these people were harassed very early on, from 2015. Like before the local elections, I talked to the candidate for the mayor in Kramatorsk, like the biggest city in the northern part of the oblast. And she told me, okay, from the moment I decided to run for mayor, my credit card was blocked. And I didn't understand. I went to the bank. I said, what's going on? I can't use my credit card anymore. And the bank told them, well, sorry, we can't do anything about it. And then she discovered that she got a message that, okay, if you want to be able to use a credit card again, you have to step down as candidate for mayor. So she stepped down as candidate for mayor. And she managed to get the use of a credit card back again, right? This was 2015. This is how it was working. So the opposition bloc, the biggest political party in Donbass, was not able to present a candidate in the second biggest city of the Donetsk Oblast controlled by Ukraine. It was mind-blowing. And I discovered that talking directly to her, right? And then I talked to other people in Mariupol from the same political party, and they said they were not allowed to hold rallies. Whenever they were trying to organize signatures for some petitions in the streets, like people do in any democratic country, they were basically stopped by some mob, people wearing masks, who would come and just beat them up. And they would have to run away. It happened twice in Mariupol. Until they decided, okay, we cannot do normal campaigning. We can't do it. And one of the politicians even told me that the chief of police of Donetsk Oblast said that they would not allow the opposition bloc to hold rallies. So, if you talk about political freedom from 2015, there was none if you belong to the opposition. So they go, oh, yeah, if you support joining NATO, joining the EU, no problem. You will never be intimidated, right? So, of course, there's, oh, there is democracy in Ukraine because you have 10, 12, 20 different parties who can campaign normally and so forth, but they're all saying the same thing. I was an election observer in 2020 in Western Ukraine. There were all these different parties that did not complain about anything special, but because they were all following the same motto, well, pro-NATO and pro-EU, and that's it. Nobody else was allowed to say anything else. The opposition bloc still managed to present candidates for, even though they could not campaign normally. And still, they managed to get big amounts of votes in Russian-speaking areas, especially Donbass, but also Odessa region and so forth, Odessa city. So in spite of the fact that their political freedom was limited, they managed still to have significant votes. And then Zelensky forbid this party. Zelensky decided to arrest the party leader from 2021, before the Russian intervention. So what is a country where sitting president decides to arrest his main political opponent for, fake charges on top of it when you look at it? What is it? And then, yep.
Yeah. So you bring up Zelensky. I want to ask you about that. We just learned last week about this massive scandal. We've been covering this here for a few years, which is the theft of U.S. tax dollars, EU tax EU money as well, by a corrupt Zelensky government. We now know that his inner circle stole hundreds of millions of dollars. They found bags of cash in their houses, multiple houses, cars. When I spoke today to Maria Zarakova from the Russian Federation, who's Putin's press spokeswoman, I asked her that question about the corruption. She specifically said that it's much bigger than anyone can imagine. She said that Viktor Orban's assessment of what's going on in Ukraine is like, he likened it to a mafia, a money laundering operation that's massive. We're talking about houses, international mafia, where these houses and money is just laundered into Ukraine and it's going out to Ukrainians who have moved to Mallorca, I mean, all over the world. So can you talk in your experience about some of the, maybe the corruption piece that you might have uncovered while you were there inside? And would you say that that's accurate? Would you agree with what Maria Zarakova has to say about the corruption inside of Zelensky's circle, that it's much bigger?
I don't have first-hand information about what's going on at the highest level. But while I was in Ukraine, I heard different stories of corruption at the local level from regular citizens or even mayors. Like there was one mayor of a city of, it was called Dzerzhinsk at that time, Nizhny Toretsk, Torresque municipality. And, you know, he told me a story about how money from the embassy of Japan, actually, that he was supposed to get for some big project in his city, how the money disappeared. And he told me, like, if you can convey a message to Western countries, is that never give money to the Ukrainian state, because it's going to disappear. If you want to invest money in Ukraine, give it to the local people on the ground. If you give it to higher level, it will disappear. So, and I was aware of that very early on. And then there was a normal citizen when I was in Mariupol who came to me and said that he was subjected to a huge blackmail from a local prosecutor. You know, and local prosecutor basically asked him. He was like a small entrepreneur. He owned a building facing the court building. And the local prosecutor told him, okay, well, you have to sell me your building for nothing. You have to give it to me. And he said, what? are you kidding? No way. Oh, really? Well, you're going to have problems. And then he started to be attacked, him and his family, his wife, his kids, physically attacked. And then he still did not want to basically cede his building. So then they tried to harass him with various complaints. He had five different cases against him from the prosecutor, this corrupt prosecutor. And then the guy investigating about this prosecutor, who is this guy? Who's behind him? And according to him, I don't have the evidence, but he came to see me with a file that thick, which he says, I can give you my file. Please help me. And he basically said that this prosecutor was working with the mafia. And he said he was protected by people above him. And at some point, he brought his case all the way to a court of appeal in Kiev. And he said, when the judges looked at my case and when they saw the name of that prosecutor, they closed the case. And they said, sorry, we're not competent. And they said the hearing lasted 15 minutes. And then he came to us because he said, I'm desperate. I don't know how to defend my rights in my own country because the justice system doesn't defend me. Oh, what I forgot to mention is that his building in the end was taken over by thieves who had weapons. And that was before the conflict in Donbass, actually. It was before. But this story told me, okay, so the judicial system in Ukraine is totally corrupt. You know, stories like this can exist. It shows something. And he was also telling me stories about how judges also were involved in pedophilia scandals. I remember I never wrote about these in my notebooks, in my reports. And then when I prepared my book, you know, I went through all my notes and I found stories that I had forgotten about, like these stories about pedophilia. In those days, I was very disturbed by such stories. So I was kind of burying them. You know, didn't want to dig into that.
Yeah, a lot of people do. For whatever reason, I talk about that often on the show. For whatever reason, like child trafficking, pedophilia, we kind of, it's hard for us. We kind of block it off and we can focus on the other crimes. But these deeply dark crimes that, that's what I was going to ask you. You kind of preempted me there. In Ukraine, we've heard horrible stories of child sex trafficking, pedophilia, and that it's facilitated in many ways at the highest levels of the government. So sorry to continue, but I'd like you to talk about that. And if you saw a lot of examples of child trafficking and pedophilia.
Well, at some point I had a meeting with local police officers in Mariupol who were in charge of human trafficking. I was there with a colleague. I was not leading the conversation, but I was just like there. And basically, they were mostly focusing, as they told us, on cases of young women who would be tricked into getting jobs abroad, don't want to specify a specific country, but in foreign countries, in the Balkan area or in the Middle East. And in the end, they fell into traps of forced prostitution. So they were following cases like that. But in Ukraine as such, they didn't talk much about what they could find. And I didn't have the impression that there was a lot of human trafficking in Donbass back then because it was heavily policed. You had like military and police all around. So it was the same when I was working in Bosnia and Herzegovina. At some point, I was told that Sarajevo was the most secure capital city in Europe by far because of so many military people around and foreign military in those days. So there was a similar effect maybe in Donbass during the conflict. But once, while I was traveling in a train between Kiev and Donbass, I talked to a woman, a young woman, who was working in one of his clinics where they actually sell babies, literally. And she explained to me how it worked. And she said, oh, basically, you know, we have customers who come and we show them a catalog. And she said, in our catalog, we propose them different options. So they can basically buy a woman's belly for a limited period of time. And there was even one option. You could basically request that the woman who is impregnated actually stays locked inside the clinic for the whole duration of the pregnancy, for the whole 9 months. It's like being in jail for 9 months, just to make sure. And the woman would be like watched thoroughly to make sure she doesn't smoke, to make sure she doesn't drink, to make sure she doesn't do anything that could hurt the child. They offered that in their catalog, right? So, but it was more expensive, right? If you wanted that.
Exactly. So it's like a menu, a catalog that you could just pick through and choose that I want to have a woman, I want to have a baby. That's the woman that I want, and I want her locked here inside of this clinic for 9 months or longer.
No, actually, the woman would sign
against her will
a contract saying, okay, I agree. I agree to be locked in for 9 months because she was paid, right? It was like, you know, capitalism, if you say. But, you know, it's still very strange. And you say, what is it? I mean, is it normal to allow such things? But when I was talking to her, she didn't have any moral issue with it. For her, it seemed completely normal. That surprised me. You know, I was like, wow, is it possible to do this kind of thing?
I've heard many reports of the baby making factories in Ukraine. We've covered them again here on the show, where they show these facilities. They show, and a lot of them are sort of like underground bunkers, from at least one or two of them that I've covered here on the show. They're sort of like underground bunkers, like sort of below, where there's incubators, there's all sorts of baby materials, and where these women sort of churn out these babies. And they're sold off.
I can tell you one case.
Do you know where they're sold off to?
Once in a while, I was flying back
countries
home,
are buying
country.
Ukrainian?
Oftentimes I was flying through Amsterdam because Air France and KLM, the Dutch company, have a partnership. So, and once on these flights, you know, when we actually, just before boarding the plane in Kiev, where we were in this shuttle bus, you know, on the tarmac, I could hear the voice of a very young baby crying, you know, and you can realize it's a very young baby, maybe 1 week old, not too much older than that. And I was very surprised because I never heard such a tone of a voice outside, you know. And so I was trying to figure out, where does this voice come from? And the only thing I saw was a guy standing in front of me wearing a T-shirt, happy to be a young dad, written in French. And say, oh, okay. And he was looking towards the direction where the cries of the baby came from. Okay, so I think he must be the dad, right? And I figured, okay, then his wife is sitting somewhere. Oh, so I assume it was a wife. But then when we got off the shuttle bus, then I realized that the person who was holding the baby was another man. They looked very much alike, like in their early 30s, beard. Both of them had a beard, well cut, you know, well dressed, so it looked like they had money, and then I realized, okay, it's like a gay couple, and they just got a baby in Ukraine, which is 1 month, 1 week old. And then they got into the plane, and then when we arrived in Amsterdam, I saw they jumped the queue. I saw them, you know, on my left side, and they went all the way to the custom officers with a pile of documents and the baby in their arms. And the custom officers looked through the documents. It took maybe 2 minutes. And then she gave the documents back, and they were allowed in. Now, then I checked. You know, in France, buying babies abroad is forbidden, right? It's forbidden by law. But actually, I checked afterwards by the Netherlands from 2018, actually allowed a couple of homosexuals to buy babies. I mean, there's a legal term which I just forget right now, but the Netherlands allowed it. So then I realized, okay, so it was very clever for these guys to go through Amsterdam, the Netherlands, because the Netherlands doesn't have an issue with buying a baby in Ukraine. And once they are on the EU territory, they can go to France and nobody will control them. So, oh, that's very clever, I thought. So that's one example. And I'm pretty sure these people bought a baby in one of these baby factories in Ukraine. You know, and why would you go to Ukraine to do that? Because it's not allowed in many, many developed countries.
No, we've heard multiple reports of people throughout Europe buying babies in Ukraine, in the United States as well. And these baby-making factories, they're very lucrative. One estimation I had, $10,000 to buy a baby. And some of these women continue to churn these out. $10,000 a baby. I might be wrong on the pricing.
Yeah, let's see. No, that's the amount I cannot remember. If you had asked me that question, I would say the range of that people were paying in euros was all the way to 9,000 euros, as I remember. But it started lower, like 5,000 or 6,000 euros, all the way to 9,000, depending on, you know, how much control you want on the mother, how much demand you have, how many. So that was more or less the range that I recall about these transactions. Now, what is scary though, is that, okay, if you can buy babies like that so easily, I mean, what guarantee do you have that real criminals will not buy babies with no identity?
Right.
How can you guarantee yourself against that? And that's the scariest part.
No, that's women captured into prostitution, brought in and held against their will, babies sold off against their will, horrible things that we've heard in Ukraine. The one other big piece, and I'm reluctant to bring it up, but since we're on this topic, is the business of organ harvesting in Ukraine. Again, something we've covered here.
Yeah, we heard stories about that, but
can you tell me what you know?
But I don't have evidence. I don't have evidence about this because it's like one of the most taboo subjects. I know there were accusations from Russian social accounts from 2022. Once their Russian soldiers basically started to invade Ukraine, you could say. Yeah, I remember reading about this. I remember there was an interview of a young soldier, a sergeant, who was identified by name on the Russian media. And he said that they discovered in a house some very disturbing scenes. And he said apparently this was some houses where children were kept and for organ harvesting. And he seemed to be very disturbed when testifying about it. So he looked credible to me. But I don't know more than that. While I was there, I was not subjected to stories of this kind. But one thing I can say, though, going back to this clinic, is that the women also were to sign a commitment that they would never try to get news of the babies. They were not allowed to try to find out who would buy the babies and so forth. So even you could imagine something like a financial transaction. It's not like necessarily women forced into prostitution, but a woman comes to this clinic, she's forced to sign a contract. But she doesn't know what happens to the baby or who collects the baby. She has no clue. And by contract, she's not supposed to know. So it can be anybody, and they can do whatever they want. That's very scary. So, but, you know, I don't have evidence.
Right. Yeah. We have an idea that they might be raised in a great home, and they're playing in the backyard with their dog. But more horrible things we've uncovered, and I know... just horrible ideas that these children are sold off for the purposes of horrible things. Not having a great childhood and not being raised by great parents. And that's That's what's deeply troubling on a child sex trafficking or organ harvesting front. Deeply, deeply disturbing. Well, Benoit, you've been gracious with your time. I guess I'll get you out of here on this. You've mentioned a couple of times, indications are that we seem like we are on the precipice of World War III over this country, which we claim is a democracy, and we're fighting for democracy. How close do you think we are to a full-blown war?
Well, the more days pass, the more it seems to me Western European elites, so-called elites, political elites, media elites, are pushing us towards war with Russia. Why do so many higher-ranked people, including French generals, actually mention that we are on a collision course with Russia, that Russia is our enemy, and that we should be prepared for war within the next 3 to 4 years, or maybe sooner? And you even hear the chief of a general staff in Germany who said similar things. People in other Nordic countries, the UK, say similar things. So many people say the same thing at this high level, that you realize, okay, it's organized. They are trying to convince us that we are heading towards collision with Russia and it's inevitable. They are trying to convince the audience about it. And they are trying to convince us that Russia basically wants to recreate the Soviet Union, the Soviet Empire, and will not stop there. It will go all the way to Western Europe. And that, you know, we have to be prepared because Russia is bad, Putin is Hitler, and so forth. You know, they're the same stories they keep saying since 2022. So we are living through the fabrication of the enemy. It's pretty obvious. And what's scary is that you have unanimous speech from all these different actors that I mentioned. And, you know, you had President Trump elected in the U.S. So, I mean, I don't want to comment much of, you know, American politics. You know, I'm not well positioned for that, I guess. But it seemed that in the U.S., it's not so obvious, this push for war right now, because if you consider that the global deep state controlled the whole Western world, then it is kind of in conflict maybe with the Trump administration right now. So you don't really know in which direction they will go, you know. But in Europe, I think the globalist deep state that was controlling the Democrat Party before, okay, they lost total control of America. They haven't lost all control, but they lost most of it. And now they are trying basically to control Europe as much as they can. And this is what they do. And the problem is that the European institutions do not protect their citizens like the US Constitution does protect American citizens. No, the EU institutions are not elected. The European Commission is not elected by the people. So we have a much less democratic system in Europe. And this body, which is called the European Union, actually is trying to grab more and more responsibilities outside of signed treaties. And so this is very worrying because it looks like we citizens do not have any say about it and do not have any means to control it. It's just happening. And the mainstream media don't say anything about it. We are living through a everyday situation. It's like a coup is being arranged against the European people, against their will, and there's nothing we can do about it because it just goes progressively, right? Bit by bit, measure by measure. And that's the scariest part. Some people say that they are doing this because they realize that European economy is going down and they need to convince people that we need to step into a war economy, as that would be the only way to recover, right? We need to create like the idea of a war to boost the economy. Some people say that, but I hope it's just that, but I'm not sure. Sometimes I'm afraid that they really want the war, because maybe they think, okay, once we have war, we can impose total control, right? And the European Commission, you know, is working, is proposing different bills, which basically are more and more scrutinizing the basic freedoms of European citizens. And I know it causes problems with the US digital companies, for instance, like X or WhatsApp, because basically the European Union wants to spy on all our conversations. You know, the first there was the DSA, the Digital Service Act, that was passed. And now it's a different bill called chat control. Okay, last time, recently, it was like rejected because there was no majority in favor of it. But they want to propose it again in December, I think. They are not giving up. Even though, you know, American tech companies are against it because they say it will infringe on the rights of US citizens. But it doesn't seem to bother them. They keep pushing for it. So I'm worried. We have to see how it goes. But if it goes through, this chat control bill, that would be very worrying for freedom of expression in Europe. And I read stories every day about the UK, about Germany, in France, also in France to some degree, about people being arrested for posts they basically put on the social networks, right? So we no longer have freedom of expression in Europe. If you challenge some of the wrong people, you can be arrested in your own home. No, there's no freedom of speech anymore. It's very limited. So we still have now some margin, some spaces where you can still talk, but I'm thinking for how long? So we'll see how it goes. But I'm not optimistic, to tell you the truth, but we'll see how it goes. But that's also why, because I want to counter this narrative of a Russian fear, because I think it's completely fabricated, completely fake. And I want to play my role in trying to offer truth to counter these lies, because this is a bunch of lies for a very dishonest and dark purpose. And I don't want to be complicit in that. And that's why I'm talking to people like you, because I think people who can speak out and raise truthful elements to counter this war-mongering narrative, we should speak out, because it's now or never, because, you know, then it might be too late. So I don't want to have regrets later on and thinking, oh, I should have spoken out more. No, I think it's we are living in very dangerous time, and now it's not time to calculate and think about our own little advantages. We need to say what we think needs to be said to try to avoid a catastrophe.
Well, thank you for everything that you've done to expose this story. My guest has been Benoit Paré. He's the author of the book, What I Saw in Ukraine, The Diary of an International Monitor from 2015 to 2022. Benoit, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much also for your invitation and for everything that you do.
Thank you.
You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. Yet you still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is, managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all of your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money you wasted. Plus, you can use the smart savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved them more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play stores.